Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. My name is Eric Rivenis, and glad to have you here. I'm pleased to have as my guest today Paul Thomas Murphy, author of Shooting Victoria and the book we're discussing today, Pretty Jane and the Viper of Kidbrook Lane, a true story of Victorian law and disorder, the unsolved murder that shocked Victorian England. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I have to ask you right off the bat, you've written a wonderful book on a murder in historic turn-of-the-century London. This is actually your second Victorian-era book set in England, but you're an American. How did you become so interested in a place so far away?
I've sort of spent years in Victorian England in a way because my academic training is I'm a Victorianist. I taught it. I was actually specialized in Victorian literature, and then about 10 years ago took a shift into history and then started looking at some footnote figures in Victorian history and started looking at the assassins, would-be assassins of Queen Victoria. They all failed. And that got me into the first book. So from then on, it's been Victorian nonfiction.
So how did you come across this specific murder, and what motivated you to write about it?
Yeah, this one was really a happy accident, because when I was finishing with Shooting Victoria, I was back in London sort of checking the archives one more time and sort of doing a little premature celebration of being done with the book. And one of my friends there happens to be his spare time a guide at a cemetery in South London, Broccoli and Ladywell Cemetery. And when we were out prematurely celebrating, I was already sort of looking for a new idea and asked him if he was going to write a book about anybody in that cemetery, who would it be? And he immediately said Jane Clouseau, and then said, "Oh, let me die," which was probably her last words. And then told me a little bit about what he knew about the murder. And it right from the start, it seemed like a fascinating story. But I told him I'd look into it, see if it really there was a book in it, and dug into it. And I believe there was. And so I wrote it.
So let's start where you start in your book, a police constable walking a remote beat on April 26th, 1871, makes a really horrifying discovery. Can you talk about that discovery?
Yeah, it's on a abandoned, at least at that time in the morning, country lane. He first thinks it's just a heap of clothing, and then he realizes it's a body. And he at first thinks that it's just this part of the lane was notorious as a lover's lane, and he was pretty sure it was somebody who had just been a woman who had been sort of dumped by an ungallant lover, I guess. Then he realized when he actually looked more closely that she had been horribly injured, was battered around the head, and he found assistance, got her to Guy's Hospital, which was several miles away in Southwark. And 5 days later, she died. But it was a horrendous murder.
When he discovers her body, she's still conscious.
She drifts back into consciousness just enough time to say those words, "Oh, let me die," and asks him. She's actually gets up on her hands and knees and asks him to hold her hand. And he's so horrified at first that he can't react. And by the time he does, it's too late. She falls. But she was just in conscious that long to say that. And even though she lived 5 days longer, she never came back to consciousness, certainly never came back, never was able to identify her killer, for one thing.
And she also says, "Oh, my head, my poor head," or something to that effect, right?
Right. And then, "Oh, let me die." And that's it.
So where did this happen in relation to the city of London? And what did the area look like in 1871?
This is outside the town, the small town of Eltham, just north of there and southeast of Greenwich, which is a town on the southeast periphery of London. It's just at the edge of metropolitan London. And it's just, even though, you know, you think of, I mean, London at the time was the largest city in the world, this was just getting past the urban development and into really isolated countryside. Her body was there for hours and hours, and nobody passed it, except perhaps the police officer himself who found her. He found her at about 4:30 in the morning, and it was on his beat. He had one of the most remote beats in metropolitan London. But his beat had taken him past the same spot 2 hours before, but he walked it in the dark. He had a lantern, but he didn't use it. And almost certainly he walked right by her. So it was, even though we're in London and it's the London Metropolitan Police on the job, it is one of the most remote parts of London. And I think that is one reason why the murderer chose that spot to do his work.
So in the minutes and hours following the discovery of Jane, what do the police do? And what does their initial investigation look like?
Yeah, their initial investigation is very zealous. I mean, they jumped to the task. They guarded the crime scene. Actually, the officer who found her was sent back to the crime scene to protect it from any passerby who might sort of damage the scene. There was quite a bit of evidence. There was footprint evidence. There was blood evidence, obviously. There was a pattern in the mud that showed a horrendous struggle had taken place. And they did realize the importance of sort of keeping that intact to a point, because by noon that day, a number of police had assembled on the scene and a number of police had tramped around the scene. And really, they did about the best they could to completely taint the crime scene. In the end, footprint evidence could have been crucial in this case, but in the end, they took no footprint evidence. They knew about 1871. They knew about that part of an investigation. They used plaster of Paris to take impressions of feet, but nobody did it. And in a short time, nobody could do it. So that's one of the main things that they did. In the days afterwards, the murder weapon, at least the hammer that was almost certainly used to kill Jane was discovered about a mile away towards Greenwich. And with that, they had a clue to work on, and they really used the resources of the police to track down the store in which that was bought. And they succeeded in the end at finding that. So that they were able to do as well. And in a short time, within a couple of days, they realized how that this was an important case and enlisted Scotland Yard in the case. And they had a Scotland Yard detective named John Mulvaney who pretty much took charge of the investigation at that point.
And did the investigation get better when he took charge?
It did and it did. I mean, there was a clearer chain of command, I think, and some of the evidence worked its way up the chain of command. They found, for one thing, right at the scene of the struggle, one officer dug out a little metal whistle. It was a dog whistle. It's actually not quite what we think of when we think of a dog whistle, but because it made an audible sound. But they pulled that out of the mud. John Mulvaney, when he took over the case, he scrutinized the evidence, and he actually took some of the evidence into his own hands and sort of kept it. And one of the things he kept was the whistle. The problem is that neither he nor anybody else actually logged the whistle as evidence, and that allowed the defense in the trial that followed to claim that perhaps they planted that whistle. So there was a little bit of confusion about how to handle the evidence, even on John Mulvaney's part.
Who are some of the people they questioned? There must have been people in the area of some interest.
There were a number of witnesses. Nobody actually saw the actual attack. No eyewitness saw the actual attack. The police, based upon witness accounts, began to put together the idea, the theory that Jane had been attacked in the evening before, on the 25th of April, and had sort of lain there injured for a number of hours. And they were able to do that because they had a couple witnesses. Remember, this was a lover's lane, basically, and it was on this April evening. There was at least one couple who were also on that lane, and they said that they heard screams. And they also claimed to have seen somebody running away from the scene very soon after the screams. So they saw that. There was another witness. His name was Lizelle, who said that around 6 o'clock that evening, he had passed a couple. And although he didn't recognize the female, he did recognize the male, who turned out to be the prime suspect, basically, that the police had. So there were people that did see something, and what they saw and who they saw became an important part of the case, as there were identification parades or police lineups that a number of them took place. And this is actually very early on in that kind of identification. And the police made some interesting decisions as far as that goes, too, as far as how to get a clear idea of who eyewitnesses saw through lineups. I can give you one example of a very curious police lineup. There was one man that said he was walking down the lane and saw a couple who were apparently arguing on the lane that night. And he said he really only saw the male from the back. And the police actually set up an identification for him in the police yard or in the prison yard, Newgate. And they marched out the prime suspect, whose name was Edmund Pook, and a number of police officers in plain clothes. And he said, well, I can't really identify him from the front. So they had every single one of them turn around. And from the back, he actually identified Edmund Pook as the one that he claims he saw.
Wow. So let's go back a little bit and talk about Edmund Pook and his family. Who is Edmund Pook, and how does he become their prime suspect?
Yeah, well, Edmund Pook, they learned, Jane, they hadn't identified for 5 days after the attack. And actually, really kind of sadly, they identified her within an hour or so of the moment of her death. which was actually, she died on May 30th and on April 30th. And by May 1st, they knew who she was. And after that, things happened very, very quickly. The Pook family lived in downtown Greenwich. Ebenezer Pook was Edmund's father, was a printer, a successful printer, right in the heart of the town. And they employed a single servant, a maid of all work, and that was Jane Clouson. So Edmund Pook was the young master, and Jane was, she was a servant. And they, in talking to family members, Jane's cousins, Jane's aunt and uncle, they learned that Jane told them anyway that she had been seeing Edmund Pook, that they were lovers. And she even told one witness that she and Edmund Pook were running off that night to get married. So they knew there was a connection, at least according to a number of witnesses, between Edmund Pook and Jane that went beyond just a servant and a young master relationship. And with that, they went to talk to the Pooks. They brought in Edmund. They confronted him with the evidence. He denied it. They sort of searched through his clothes. And in the end, as they were sitting and talking, they noticed bloodstains on his trousers. And based upon that, based upon what they had heard from witnesses, and I believe based upon Edmund's general reaction and behavior, they thought they had enough to arrest him for her murder, and they did on May 1st.
And police soon learned that she was pregnant, too.
She was pregnant. Actually, that they also discovered in the postmortem just that day, actually. They actually found another witness who claimed that Jane had confided to her that she was pregnant and that Edmund Pook was the father. And that witness came forward once, but interestingly enough, disappeared pretty much before the trial.
I mean, on the surface, it seems like it had to have been pretty much a slam dunk case for the police, right?
I think that's what they thought. I think they thought it was pretty much open and shut. And then things began to fall apart for the prosecution. And a lot of that, I think, had to do with the fact that the Pooks got incredible legal assistance. Their solicitor, who was, and this kind of made things confusing in writing all of this, was a man by the name of Pook. He was Henry Pook. He lived in Greenwich as well, but he was no relation to the Pooks at all. He was an incredibly tenacious and zealous solicitor who I think formed a very, very strong bond with the family. I mean, he wasn't Edmund's uncle, but he sort of fought as if Edmund was a family member for him. He was able to sort of question a lot of the evidence. The witness accounts began to sound very, very questionable. I mean, it was more than just seeing Edmund from the back. The people that said they heard screams, the two witnesses said they weren't screams of agony or terror. They were screams of pleasure on Lover's Lane, and that sort of didn't help. The key witness that claimed he had seen Edmund Pook with a young woman on Kidbrook Lane that night turned out to be a terrible witness. He had an odd grimace and a stammer, and he basically was easily confused and was also shown that his timeline, basically. He said that he saw Jane a good hour before anybody else heard or saw anything on the lane, or just saw Edmund and Jane. And that just didn't hold up. And in fact, the witness that last saw Jane in Deptford, where she was before she left towards Kidbrook Lane, said that Jane had, and they asked somebody with a watch what time it was just before Jane left. And that was just 10 minutes before this other witness said that Jane was on Kidbrook Lane. And this is, we're talking, 3.5 miles distance from one point to the other. It was just impossible. So a lot of the evidence just began to fall apart pretty quickly.
This was a really sensational story, wasn't it? Both before and during the trial. The public takes a huge fascination with all of this, don't they?
They do. I mean, it's partly, I mean, what first got it going, I think, was the fact that they found this woman who was horrendous. You know, the injuries were horrendous, and they were Victorian newspapers tended to dwell upon those kinds of details. And so the news of the attack and the very specifics of the attack spread across the country pretty quickly. And because she wasn't discovered her identity wasn't discovered for 5 days, there was a whole lot of speculation about who this could be. They knew she was a servant, and they knew that long before they knew her name, because she had calluses on her elbows and knees, and this was a sign of years and years of hard labor, hard servant's labor. But that's all they knew, and the speculation went pretty wild, and there are some very interesting accounts that say a lot about, I think, the Victorians and the way they looked at women and a woman in this situation. The long and the short of it is that they assumed that this had to be a woman who, in Victorian terms, was a fallen woman. She had fallen, and they came up with a number of specific but completely wrong guesses as to who she was. There was that sort of sensational aspect of it. And this was, I mean, in terms of the literature of the time, this was the age of sensation. And I think as the case played out, once they realized it was Jane and once they saw Edmund as the possible killer of Jane, there was a story there, I think, that captivated the public. And I think that Edmund Pook, who was arrested, was put in jail without bail to sort of see if he could be tried. And then when he was committed for trial, was put in Newgate for over a month. His behavior, I think, attracted a great deal of attention too. He either was the in the eyes of the public a complete victim himself, who was completely wrongly accused, or he was one of the coolest criminals that anybody had ever experienced.
I mean, it's really the age-old tale of privileged young men bedding their families' servant girls. And I'm sure it left a bad taste in the mouths of many people. A lot of assumptions, I'm sure, were made.
Right. There was an assumption, and I think the police could be accused of making that assumption too, although they did have some evidence to support them in that claim. There were others that came forward and pointed out that Edmund had an interest in another servant, kind of an interest at the same time, that actually didn't pan out in the end. But he seemed to be the type that would do that. At least that's what the press was representing, and that's what the police were working on. It is, interestingly enough, when his family heard this accusation, I mean, they didn't know about it until the 1st of May when the police came to their door either. He had a brother and a mother and father, and they all argued against that, jumping to that conclusion. They said he couldn't have done it, not our Edmund, not our son, because number one, he was just not that type of person, and number two, he couldn't do it because he was always, they always kept an eye on him. Edmund Pook, as it happens, was an epileptic and subject to epileptic attacks. And according to his family, they were afraid to let him go out on his own. So this is something that they said if he had had any familiarities with that servant, they'd know about it. And therefore, there was nothing to this story.
So where do you think the truth lies regarding their relationship?
Well, it really, a lot of it comes down to whether you believe Jane or not, whether you believe that Jane told her cousin and told several other witnesses, including the friend where she was staying after she left the Pooks, that she and Edmund were lovers. Nobody ever, there was not a single eyewitness who could claim to have seen Edmund and Jane ever walking together. Interestingly enough, Edmund Pook, when he was the day he was arrested, threw up an alternative theory, which was that when he was walking, he said he saw Jane out walking with a young gent. And then he called up his brother, and his brother agreed that Edmund had told him that exactly that days before. So interestingly enough, Edmund Pook was, it turns out, the only one to have seen Jane with another male, at least the only one to claim that. And it's interesting that nobody else, if Jane was walking out with a gent, there was nobody else once this case became, you know, the topic of conversation in Greenwich, in Deptford, in that entire area, was able to come forward and corroborate his claim. So the lack of another possible suspect for killing Jane, also for getting Jane pregnant, is, I think, significant. And the fact that his family's claims that they kept an eye on him at all times clearly fell through in examination, in the magistrate's hearing and in the trial, because we learned that Edmund Pook was out of the family sight many times, that Edmund Pook had a girlfriend, you know, that I mentioned that there was a whistle pulled out of the mud at the scene of the crime. The police later found out in tracking down one of his acknowledged girlfriends that he used that whistle to actually, this doesn't sound too much like a gentleman, but he used that whistle to call her when he went to her house and wanted to, so that her parents didn't know about him. And he often visited her house and often called her away from it with the dog whistle. So that clearly works against what the parents had to say about his whereabouts, but also his opportunity to commit this crime in the first place.
We will be right back.
Everybody, shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. Today could be the day a famous mobster met their end, or the first milestone for humans in space. Who knows what history today holds? Find out when you listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have returned.
So all sorts of witnesses were called during the trial, and a lot of twists and turns that you document in your book. What was the verdict when it was all over?
Yeah, the trial in the end, it was held in July, July 12th through 15th. In the end, Edmund Pook was acquitted. The actual Solicitor General of England was there for the prosecution, and he was a formidable. His name was Coleridge. He was actually a great grandnephew of Samuel Taylor Coleridge. He was a pretty formidable legal force, but he was just coming off an exhausting case just before this. It's actually the case of the Tichborne claimant, a very well-known Victorian case. And interestingly enough, the judge in Edmund Pook's trial was also coming off that case, and they were both exhausted. And I think it shows in the trial. I don't think it was Coleridge's best case by a long shot. But the trial hinged upon eyewitness evidence, and it hinged upon the possibility of admitting Jane's words, Jane's hearsay evidence, and Jane's hearsay evidence was not admitted, and the witnesses, all the ones that we talked about, were pretty thoroughly taken care of by Edmund's defense. And another witness that we haven't talked about, named Walter Richard Perrin, turned out to be a complete liar, completely made up his testimony, and he was discredited, and I think that tainted the defense case altogether. Edmund Pook, in the end, was completely acquitted, and keep in mind the newspapers were reporting this trial day by day, and once he was acquitted, cheers erupted in the courtroom, and cheers erupted outside Newgate, outside the Old Bailey, and you get a real sense that not just the people in the courtroom, but the public as a whole agreed with this verdict. The public as a whole, with the exception of quite a few people in Greenwich and Deptford, in the neighborhood where the crime took place.
Could you talk more about Walter Richard Perrin? What was his original testimony, and how was he proven a liar?
Walter Richard Perrin was interesting. He drove Edmund and Edmund's defense nuts because Edmund was committed for trial at the very beginning of June, and usually trials followed pretty quickly at the time in 1871. The trial was going to take place in June at the next session of the Central Criminal Court at the Old Bailey. In the week before the trial, Walter Richard Perrin came forward. He was bit of a character. He had dreams of being a music hall singer. He was actually a singer in a tiny music hall in Sydenham, which is also in South London. And he worked for his mother at his mother's business. She had a cab business, a horse business, and he was also, apparently they also gave donkey rides up on Blackheath, which is right next to Greenwich. And so he was called in the press quite a bit the donkey driver. He came forward with a story of being able to witness, came about as close as you could to being an eyewitness to Edmund buying the murder weapon in Deptford, at that store in Deptford where the police tracked the murder weapon to. A number of witnesses came forward, and other eyewitnesses that whose stories were tested about seeing Edmund or somebody like Edmund buying the hammer. Well, Perrin actually claimed that he knew Edmund, and that he had spoken with Edmund that night in Deptford. It was the Monday before the murder, on the street, and then watched Edmund turn around, walk into the store, and then watched the proprietress of the store go to the window and take out a plasterer's hammer, which was the murder weapon. And so he was the one that, at least according to his story, was able to connect Edmund pretty clearly to the hammer. The problem was that for whatever reasons, and just achieving notoriety is very likely the main one of those. He didn't see any of it. He wasn't there, and Edmund's defense was able to destroy his credibility and pretty much tear his story apart in pretty short order. Whether he hoped to help the defense or, you know, if he even had that in mind, he actually served to do the prosecution. He did just the opposite. He destroyed their case. He made every single witness for the prosecution tainted. So, yeah, he Walter Richard Perrin, if there's anybody that single-handedly ruined the case against Edmund Pook, it was him.
Talk, if you will, about this shift in public perception of Edmund Pook. At the beginning, when he's named a suspect and arrested, he draws hostile crowds at train stations, etc. But when the trial is over, he's being cheered. What is the reason for this change of mood?
Well, it is. I think it's a partial shift. I guess it's a shift in the general public opinion. I mean, the opinion that sort of the nationwide opinion about the case. I mean, at first, as you said, I mean, it seemed like an open and shut case, and the evidence seemed to be really going against him. And I think the real shift happened. It could have been begun during the very, very long process. The sort of the pre-trial process with the magistrate's hearing and the inquest, both of those, the inquest in Southwark and the magistrate's hearing in Greenwich, met five or six times each, met over the course of the month of May. And all of that was widely reported. And so you could see the evidence being tested and challenged by that solicitor, Henry Pook. And therefore, I think there was some question even before going into trial whether Edmund Pook did it or not. But I think the trial was what really pushed things over the edge. I think that the reporting of the trial every day and seeing the defense witnesses, really their stories, what there were of those stories, and there were actually a number of alibi witnesses that proved, at least according to their testimony, that Edmund Pook could not have been anywhere near the scene of the crime at the time. Those witnesses' testimony held up, and the prosecution witnesses, by and large, fell apart. And by the fourth day of the trial, anyway, the last day of the trial, I think there was a very strong sense that people kind of forgot about Jane and her being the victim, and there was much more sort of immediate sense that Edmund Pook was the victim of a zealous police department who went too far, who wanted to get their man to the point that they chose him, and then they did their best to invent a case against him. Yeah. That was the general feeling. There was a very, very different feeling again in Greenwich, at least among the largely working class population of Greenwich and Deptford and Lewisham and really southeast London. Their feeling was very different, where the crowd outside the Old Bailey in central London cheered the results of that case. Another crowd, a larger crowd, had actually been assembling in Greenwich outside the Pook's home, and their feeling was exactly the opposite. And they began to howl. They began to protest. They did everything they could to make it clear that they did not agree with that verdict.
So this was a pretty pivotal period in English law, wasn't it? The older, more antiquated views of the law and police procedure were being tossed out the door for more modern views.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Sort of two ways to look at that. This is the sort of pre-reform legal system in England. There were sort of, and actually a lot of the laws, a lot of the procedures, a lot of what Edmund Pook went through were based upon precedents that stretch back to the Plantagenets, to the Middle Ages. And just a couple years after 1873, the first of a number of sweeping legal reforms were passed that changed the structure of the of British law. The whole idea of a court of common pleas and the court of exchequer and the court of the Queen's Bench, as it was then and actually is now, that was all abolished, and certain kinds of judges, certain kinds of positions changed as well. But also certain types of procedures have shifted. For one thing, in Edmund Pook's trial in 1871, defendants could not. It's not that they could choose not to, but they could not. They were legally not entitled to testify in their own defense. So Edmund Pook wasn't faced with that decision that I think people are, the accused are in criminal trials now, as to whether to stand up and tell his story or not. He couldn't do it. There were also different rules. There were different hearsay rules, and that was obviously important to this case as well.
So what happened to Edmund Pook? How did he live the rest of his life?
Well, he walked free. He actually lived for another almost 50 years. He died, I believe, in 1920. So had a good long life. Worked at his father's printing business. When his father died, he and his mother ran the shop. He got married several years later. He had a child. The child actually lived, sadly, for only 2 years and then died. He mostly lived around Greenwich, which was interesting because there was this real sense that he had disappeared. I mean, there seemed to be this odd sort of universal belief that he wasn't around anymore. And that actually, several years after the case, he had pretty much disappeared from, obviously, from the headlines, disappeared from public memory. But then there was a story that he had died, and so he was brought back for a little bit. The problem is that he hadn't died. It was somebody named John Pook, who is not any relation to him at all. But the interesting thing is that if reporters were had enough initiative, they could have tracked him down easily. He was living in Greenwich at the time, but you get the sense that he was kind of hiding in plain sight. The turbulence after the trial really got to him, I think. I mean, again, I was talking about the crowd that just refused to believe that he should have been acquitted and were vehement in demanding justice for Jane long after that. Edmund Pook, the Pook family refused to leave. I mean, the family itself stayed and sort of weathered the storm. But Edmund Pook actually did disappear. He actually took off. He went into a rural Kent, a town fairly nearby, called Herne Bay, but there's a sense that the strain did get to him. There's also, actually, if we're talking about what happened with Edmund Pook, I should point out that the story, at least the legal story, didn't end with his acquittal. Obviously, he couldn't be tried for the same crime again, but because there were people that protested the verdict, that there was one man in particular, a man by the name of Newton Crossland, who wrote a pamphlet and letters to the editor to a paper, which in some detail talked about the trial as being a travesty. Because of that, the Pooks, Edmund, his father Ebenezer, and their solicitor Henry, made the dubious decision that they would try to scotch any attempt to claim Edmund might have done it. And the way they did it was by basically suing anybody. And I mean any. I mean, there were a good dozen libel trials that they initiated or tried to initiate to sue anybody who would dare claim or publish a claim or sell a claim, sell Crossland's pamphlet in particular, that Edmund Pook was the killer. And so the litigation started up again and lasted actually well into 1872. And that kept the trial alive. And that also had the effect of changing public opinion about Edmund Pook and the case.
So at the end of your book, you draw some personal conclusions to the story. Who do you think killed Jane Clouson?
Okay. Interestingly, as you pointed out, the subtitle of the book is A True Story of Victorian Law and Disorder. In the U.S., in the U.K., they decided to go with a different subtitle, Victorian Murder Mystery Solved, which puts a lot of pressure on me with those last few pages. But I think that one interesting thing about the case to me is that there's an abundance of evidence, and there are not just the trial transcripts, but the very thorough reports of the police investigations and the very lengthy testimony in the magistrate's trial and in the inquest, as well as the civil case. The thing about the civil case is that Edmund Pook, who couldn't testify in the criminal case, had to testify in the civil case. He had to go on the stand because he was the one who had to say that this person who claimed that he was Jane Clouseau's killer was a liar because he couldn't have done it. So he had to establish that case. Based upon all of that, there is a great deal of evidence, and I believe that it's evidence well worth revisiting. We're talking about the forensics in 1871. They had the same kinds of concerns. They were looking at the same kinds of things that we'd look at today in a case like that. There's the footprint evidence. There was also blood evidence, and there was also there were hairs found upon the hammer, the murder weapon. So there was all of that. But you get a sense that this is really the very, very beginning of the what I would call the forensic age, the age of forensic investigation. And it's pretty interesting what they were able to come up with, what they were able to deduce. But it's also interesting to see what they couldn't deduce from this. I mean, there is no physical evidence left from the case. Actually, interestingly, Jane's clothing was a part of the Black Museum, which is now called the Crime Museum at Scotland Yard, but it disappeared a long time ago. And the hammer evidence, that has disappeared. So we don't have that to go by, but we do have the physical descriptions. We know that the substance that the police found in Edmund's clothing was blood. We know that because there was a specialist at the time who did a very sophisticated chemical analysis and concluded without doubt that there was blood. That's as far as they could go at the time. They didn't have any knowledge of blood, obviously DNA, no knowledge of blood types, but really didn't even know how to distinguish to a certainty between human blood and animal blood, or at least mammalian blood. So all of that they didn't know at the time. But they did have a very clear idea of the blood evidence as it appeared on Edmund's clothing, and there were a number of descriptions of that. And I think that evidence, as well as the hearsay evidence that was excluded, but I would argue would not be excluded in a British courtroom today, both pointed pretty clearly to Edmund Pook as the killer of Jane Clouseau.
And that is your personal belief?
I have to admit, I mean, it's when I was looking at this case, it's important, I think, when you're gathering the details, as I think you could say the same thing would have been important for the Metropolitan Police at the time, to keep an open mind, and I did. But there are many things about the case that point to Edmund Pook in the way that, again, I think it pointed to Edmund Pook for the police. One thing that I didn't mention about the day that Edmund Pook was arrested was what he said, actually, when Jane Clouseau, when the police told him about Jane Clouseau. And this, again, was at least when he was the first time he was supposed to have heard about the identity of the victim on Kidbrook Lane and his connection with the victim. It was a servant. She had lived with him for 2 years in that house. And he very coldly said, when they said, "Your servant is dead," he said, "She was a dirty girl and left in consequence." And it was actually a story that the rest of the Pooks sort of took up and repeated. She was dirty, and that's why she left. She actually left the Pooks' house a couple weeks before she was murdered. And she left, it was clear that she left after some kind of an altercation. But that, depending on who you asked, the details of that altercation were quite different. According to her relatives, she was leaving to get another job, to work in a factory rather than to work for the Pook family anymore. And again, there was that sense that they knew that she was a lover. According to the family, she was filthy, and they had warned her several times before, but finally push came to shove, and she agreed to leave because she was filthy. That story, and also what we learn about Jane, and what I learned about Jane through, you know, sort of investigating this case, really, there's nobody else who made that claim about Jane, and there were plenty of people who made the opposite claim, that she was respectable, and in the Victorian world, respectability and cleanliness went hand in hand, and they were really making an attack on her respectability. There were others who upheld that, so there was a real belief that that the Pooks were lying, and that Edmund, when he gave that as a reason for Jane's leaving, was lying. So there were things like that that pointed to him. But really, until you look at the blood evidence and you consider the strength of the witnesses who told Jane's story as she told it to them, then you get a much stronger sense that that he did it. He did it. His excuse, his reason for blood getting on his clothes was that he was an epileptic, and that he had an epileptic attack. His brother and his family corroborated that in the weeks before, and he gave very specific details about that attack. And it's clear by looking at the blood evidence, the evidence on his clothes, the blood that he said came from blood dripping from a tongue, bitten tongue, in an attack, that the spatter evidence could not have come from biting a tongue in an epileptic attack. And the configuration pointed to, as at least one of the prosecutors was certain about and believed to the end of his life, and he lived a long life, that Edmund Pook had done it, pointed to the fact that this blood was blood thrown off in the hammer attack on Jane Clouson.
So where can people go to find out more about you and your books?
Yeah, well, the book is available, I believe, pretty much anywhere you get a book, and certainly available on Amazon. And the website is one word, prettyjaneandtheviper.com, prettyjaneandtheviper.com. Yeah, and there are a number of other, I kind of try to continue the case on that site.
Well, this has been great. Thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you.
This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. You can visit my Most Notorious Facebook page for updates on the show. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.